Hello, everybody, and welcome to Culinary Convo, going over a plate in time in 1863 with a good buddy of the pod, Andrew, who also hosts Our Last Meal, going over all the foods in 1863 in the U.S., obviously during a, upheaval time in the United States, but also going over foods a couple places elsewhere. So stay tuned for that. Also go check out Our Last Meal, where I guest spotted, but also where there's a few episodes up. Take a listen, go for it. And we will get to 1863, A Plate in Time, after a word from the sponsor. Welcome to Culinary Convo. I am your host, Devin Ream. The coffee is poured and your spot at the table is open. I've got my mise en place, and if your mind is open, let us begin. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Culinary Convo, Plate in Time. I am here today with good buddy of the pod, and I was a guest on his show just this last week of Our Last Meal, Andrew. How's it going, Andrew?
Devin, how are you? I'm doing, other than getting over a cold, I'm not doing too bad.
Yeah, yeah. Sniffles, they happen, you know?
Yeah.
Time to time.
It's when it's a summer cold, it's always the worst. I don't know what it is about it, but yeah. Other than that, doing good.
Yeah, yeah. The allergy season, it kicks in. Every now and again, I'll get the sniffles, and then I start looking around, and I'm like, oh, plant life. That's what it is.
Well, and so I'm in North Carolina, so, I mean, we're at that, we're just past the phase where everything is just like a thick layer of yellow from all the pollen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You barely tap like a shrub, and the whole thing just goes into yellow dust.
Well, you could literally go outside, lay down, and make a pollen angel. That's how bad it gets sometimes.
Oh, man. See, that's the one thing about the Midwest that I do not miss. It happens out here, but you got to be like in more open air areas rather than the forest type of areas,
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't miss that. That was like, oh man, hearing random people as you walk by, just you're just like, oh, allergies got them. But no, plate in time. We are doing a typical plate from 1863, and I say typical, it could be anywhere and anywhere in the world, but 1863, as we were talking about, first things that pop up, obviously, Civil War, good old, Union versus Confederacy, growing up in Missouri, we were, if we were below the Mason-Dixon, you were Confederate. Above it, they were the Northerners. And so I grew up in Southwest Missouri. So a lot of people, sadly, were like, we're part of the South. And it was like, I don't know, guys.
Yeah, well, so in North Carolina, I grew up with a lot of that, too. I can't tell you how many times growing up I heard, Lee surrendered, I didn't, and the South will rise again. And it's just always like, well, I don't think that we will. That's the thing,
Yeah. I don't see you guys, banding up and,
You can't rise out of the lazy boy.
Exactly. Yeah. Writing up, Federalist Papers. I don't see you guys doing that. And they're like, well, we would get the... No, you're not. Come on, Jerry, you're going to go down to, Quick Trip, and you're going to have yourself a day, and then that's going to be the end of it. Like, yeah, just get over it. And the other thing I think about 1860s-wise was it was pre-industrial revolution, right? But there was still, industrial stuff going on. Like, you had the railroads. You had a lot of steel going on. Kind of one of those things where if we weren't having a civil war, I wonder how much industrial revolution stuff would have kicked in earlier. Because there were a lot of advancements in this time, that's for sure.
That's actually really interesting. I've never thought about that, but I mean, I guess it does beg the question, how much would, without war, how much further would we have advanced as a society? I know that you have... Yeah. you know, advancements that happen because of, like, the war effort. You know, things that, oh, we're trying to figure out a better way to blow other people up. And, like, oh, we also invented Tang at the same time, you know. But I wonder, like, if we hadn't been so focused on, like, let's just try to kill as many people as we can, like, would we have flying cars now? Is that the breakdown between us and flying cars?
Probably. If I had to guess, I bet that, you know, like you mentioned, Tang era, so 1960s, we're sitting there trying to figure out how to get to the moon. You know, a lot of budget went to that Vietnam War. it's one of those things, like, history plays itself out, and we're just kind of like, you know, for some people in the 60s, it was one long acid trip. For others, it was a complete nightmare. For others, it was a civil rights struggle the entire time. And then for some, depending on their age, they were just working on a farm somewhere. Like, they hardly paid attention to what was going on. So who knows? The main thing is that, like, kind of like what you mentioned, like, well, if we didn't have that war part, what else would have taken its place?
That's very true.
Yeah. So, but no, the 1863 Platon time, looking at the libraryofcongress.gov, they go over the Civil War Thanksgiving foods.
Oh, God, this is going to be horrible.
Yeah. This is going to be woo doggy. Yeah. So, on October 3rd, 1863, in the midst of the war, President Lincoln issued a proclamation of Thanksgiving, setting aside the last Thursday in November as a day of thanksgiving and praise. The Confederate soldiers' rations consisted of cornbread, mule meat, or a meat substitute of rice and molasses.
I think I'd rather have the rice and molasses.
I think I would, too. From my understanding, mule or donkey-type meat in China, like, very rarely they would have that, you know, in certain what have you to this day. And from my understanding, it is still quite a weird meat, right? Like, even if we tried to make it popular, it would be difficult. So
I think there's been a lot of people lately trying to make eating ass popular, though. So that
true. Yeah.
But
it could be a new revolution again.
Yeah. Does it say anything about what the flavor is? Like, would it be kind of gamey or...
Gamey, yeah. From my understanding, it's like pretty much like dark meat, chicken, consistently texture-wise, and then like a gamey, you know, kind of like gamey steak, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm not proud to say this, but the way you describe it, that doesn't sound terrible.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't sound awful. And I think that's why they were like, just mule meat, cornbread. Here we go. This is going to be ours.
Well, like, I mean, I grew up on cornbread, so honestly, if there's cornbread at the table, I'm already half in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially over like a wood fire like they were doing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the rice and molasses was the meat substitute. I'm trying to think of how, like, that would just be sweet rice.
That's what it's. Well, that's what I was wondering. Is it just like, is it like a porridge almost, or are they making a rice molasses cake?
Right. You'd think it'd have to be like a cake, right? Like, it couldn't just be, because it's supposed to be a meat substitute. If you made it like a porridge, it's too runny. Like, it's. Ugh. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Rice. Yeah,
that's like, sorry guys, we didn't have any donkey meat this year, you know, but we've got some sweet rice for you.
Right. And remember, guys, we're doing really good right now. So just eat your rice molasses meat substitute.
Corporate wants you to know they really appreciate everything you're doing. So
exactly. Yeah. The higher ups, they really splurged on this. All right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But there are reports of men existing for days on handfuls of parched corn or field peas. Kush or slosh, a dish of necessity, was made by putting small pieces of beef in bacon grease. Okay. So far, so good.
Yeah,
then pouring in water and stewing it.
I'm not gonna lie, I don't hate that.
I don't hate it, but I'm just thinking, like, if you're stewing it, usually that means you let it sit and like simmer a long time. So then it's just separated beef. So I'm like
a thick layer of film on the top.
Right, right. The bacon grease all floating to the top. Yeah. Okay. Like, and that's
I'm talking myself out of this.
Right. I was gonna say, and that's the thing is they're not really telling us like, you know, and 2 pinches of salt with black pepper and a nice sear. Like, it's not, it's just like, yeah, you grab your beef, you throw it in there, and you put some bacon grease, pour water over it, and just let it cook for 4 hours. You're like, oh, no.
Yeah, I don't think that they're worried about seasonings here. I didn't hear anything about, like, thyme or sage. I think some rosemary would have done that well.
Right. It, basically, you're just grabbing grass as you're trudging across the battlefield, and you're like, I'll use this later. You know,
grass flavored beef bacon,
right?
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You just knew you needed greens. You know, that was the main thing. Yeah, but next, cornbread was crumbled in it, and the mixture was stewed again until all the water was cooked out.
Oh God! So you've got twice fried potatoes. You've got twice stewed beef parts.
Yeah.
Because it also, did it say what the cuts of beef were? Because I'm assuming we're not talking the best cuts.
It just says putting small pieces of beef.
See, so that could literally be anything.
Right. It could be oxtail. It could be the neck. Could be the cheek. Could be the tongue. Could be ribeye. Could be the loin. We have no idea. They just kept stewing it. And another dish combined Irish potatoes and green apples boiled together and mashed and seasoned with onions. That doesn't sound awful.
That, I'm trying to, I a little bit of sweetness. I would try that. If you put that in front of me right now, I would try that.
Yeah. There's a part of me that, like, if, you know, if for whatever reason I got, you know, somehow suckered in to joining the Confederacy, and I was in there, and they're like, hey, you know, you're on dish duty. We're making that Irish potato apple onion thing. I might be the only guy that's like, can we just leave the apples out? Like, I mean, potatoes and onions are great. Like, that would be more than enough, I think. That's we don't thing. Need to I've waste never, the apples.
Yeah, I've never been eating mashed potatoes and thought to myself, you know what this is missing is apple.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, can we put applesauce on top of this? That's, yeah, no. Yet another dish known as slapjack consisted of a thick mixture of cornmeal or flour and fried in bacon grease until it was brown. Perfect.
I mean, the batter is the best part of any fried item anyway, so fried cornmeal is... Perfect. I mean, my heart hurts thinking about it, like physically, but that sounds great.
Right, right. There's a small ache that kind of shows up, and you're just like, oh boy. And then you get to eat your cornmeal, you know, or the bacon grease cornmeal mixture, and you're fine, you know?
So,
you're just like, this is a good day.
Yeah, so now let me ask you, that sounds like a precursor to Hush Puppies.
Right. That's kind of what I was thinking, was it's a precursor to that. And then also, I do know from reading Jubilee, which is the 200 years of African-American cooking, that basically in the 1700s, they had, you know, kind of your corn cakes, corn bread type mixtures that they would make. And the only thing I can think of is that this was, you know, them basically being like, I want cornbread, and I kind of know what's going in it, but I don't know how to bake it, so to speak. So I'm just going to try to make, like, little silver dollar cornmeal cakes. And that's what they just basically tried to do. They're like, I think it's deep fried. And so they did it in the bacon grease, and they were just like, good enough. And then, like you said, yeah, precursor to the Hush Puppy. You know, it's, yeah. I mean, and it does say they fried it until it was brown, which that is a Hush Puppy trait.
That sounds like a Hush Puppy to me. You know, but something else you say there about the book you referenced, I mean, just that's something I don't, you know, I think some people know, but they don't appreciate enough, is that there is so much African influence on Southern food and Southern cuisine. And I say this again as somebody, you know, born and raised in North Carolina.
Right.
There is so much influence there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, literally American and African-American cooking, I don't know how you can separate the two. They're very put together, and yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, most of the kitchens that were even, it doesn't matter, all the way up and down the chain of economic status, most of the people in the kitchens cooking were African-American women or African-American men that were part of the house cooking. And it's one of those things where it's like, man, oh, man. Like, you know, we talk about a lot of the dishes that become family, what have you. As we learn going through historical things, a lot of stuff gets mixed up in the mix, you know? Yeah. Oh, this is Great Aunt Susie's collard green things. And we're like, wait a minute.
Yeah. Great Aunt Susie didn't know how to make that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think Great Aunt Susie knew. I think that she had this recipe that, she never said she wrote it. Like,
she,
you know?
She had the recipe, but she didn't say that she came up with it.
Right. Yeah. It's always kind of that mixed bag. Yeah, but looking at a picture here, there's this picture of this, it's a double-sided picture, one of those, like, you know, glass plate picture things, and it's this guy sitting on boxes of hardtack. Oh, yeah. You think we were going to talk about Civil War and not bring up hardtack? Oh.
This was the first thing that I thought of when you told me that we would be talking about 1863 was hardtack.
Right. Hardtack, you know, I think it's one of those things where I think the main reason why everybody remembers hardtack is because of how bad it is. Like, we can't fathom how people lived on this stuff. And I think for good reason, it was, like, used as a last measure. It was like, if we don't have any other rations, this is what we're going to eat. And, it shows here, hardtack, Hartford, Connecticut, the War Photograph and Exhibition Company. And now we move on to the Union. The Union soldiers' rations were somewhat better. Salt pork, ham, beans, split peas, dried fruits, hardtack, and desiccated vegetables were on the list. The unpopular desiccated vegetables were often called desecrated vegetables. These were layers of cabbage leaves, turnip tops, sliced carrots, turnips, parsnips, and a few onions. So it was like a vegetable medley. They were dehydrated in large blocks in ovens and then cut into 1 ounce cubes, issued to prevent scurvy. They were made into soup or fried. Wow.
I had to look this up while we're talking, and
yeah.
You know, you said that the Union had better rations. That feels like one of those that's like, true, but better is a very relative term in this situation.
Yes. Yes. Because hardtack and these cubes, I'm sorry, what now? Like, the rice and molasses is a little bit better than these things, probably. Oh, man. Yeah.
Oof. Yeah, and I'm looking at pictures of hardtack right now, and it just looks like a saltine made out of concrete.
Right, right. It's like a super thick saltine that has no air in it. It is a brick. Like, it is just dense. Yeah. And I remember, you know, in Missouri, right, we're going through the history classes. We would go to Wilson's Creek. That's what a Battle of Wilson's Creek. And there's a Civil War, you know, war site thing through the Park Service there. And I remember we tried hardtack, and they gave us, you know, like these little cuts of it, you know. And it did. It just tasted like flour. That was it.
Oh.
Like, it was just a flour brick. So, like, I can't imagine trying to, like, you're carrying this stuff. It's heavy. It's supposed to be substantial, and it's just flour bricks. Like,
that's the thing. It sounds like it was substantial, just not in a good way.
Right. Like, oh, man. But other recipes that the Union Army had were ash cakes, which were cornmeal mixed with salt and water, wrapped in cabbage leaves, and cooked in ashes until firm. So, kind of like a weird tamale, just nothing inside of the cornmeal, you know?
My mother-in-law makes tamales, and I got to be honest, this is another one. You put it in front of me, I'm going to tear that up.
Right, right. Totally, especially in cabbage leaves. I mean, thing. Yeah, you can just eat the whole thing. You got baked beans, baked in a kettle, placed in a hold in the ground, and then covered and banked with hot coals and allowed to cook overnight. Sometimes salt pork was added. So, baked beans.
No, and again, no, I'm not a fan of baked beans, but I will say this. I'm a firm believer pork makes just about anything better. So just the idea of adding the salted pork, right. I mean, again, I'm probably going to get seconds.
Well, and that's why I think I can't remember the wise person that said this, but that is why the pig is the most magical animal that anybody in the world figured out, because pigs can eat absolute garbage and it turns it into bacon. Like that is a magic trick that is very hard to pull off. You know, cows, it's like, oh, they eat all this grass and hay and it's beef. And it's like, yeah, okay. But like pigs, you can throw anything in front of them. They roll around in the mud. They eat it. Bacon.
I kind of feel bad for pigs. Because, I mean,
it's
got to be a lot of pressure to be that delicious. And right. And I... You know, we talked on my podcast last week. I mean, you know, I don't think either one of us are like hardcore carnivores to the point that like we don't like vegetables. You know, we're like
right
douchey about being a carnivore.
Yeah,
but I love pork. I love that. The pig is my favorite animal for no other reason than just that.
It literally has created some of the best dishes ever made.
Agreed. Like
ramen doesn't exist without pork. Like pho. I mean, everybody talks about beef pho and chicken pho, but I am sure that pot de feu, which, you know, like that's the French version. Yeah, they used pork. They used beef or pork, either one. You got bacon. You've got, you know, actual like, you know, slabs of pork belly, like, yeah, pork chops, pork loin, pulled pork. Right. That's your specialty area.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
Carnitas, that's another carnitas favorite. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Head cheese, another good one. I like head cheese. Ain't bad. That's one of those things.
I've actually never tried that.
Yeah, that's one of those things. It is way more, it's not as fatty as you think it will be. It's still fatty, but it's not as fatty as you think it will be. It's a good schmear. It's a good schmear. You just... And it's good on anything. But yeah, then the wonderful recipe here of hardtack pudding. It was pounded into a powder, mixed with water and flour if available, because there wasn't enough flour apparently, then kneaded into a dough, rolled out like a pie crust, and filled with apples, and I am quoting here, or anything.
Or... The phrase or anything is incredibly, incredibly scary to me.
Yeah, anything.
What are we going to fill this with?
Anything.
I saw some leaves over there and put it in there. You think that'll be okay? Well, it's not going to be worse. We're not going to make this worse.
Right, right. We're going to put raisins in it because there's a lot of people out here dying of diarrhea. Like, yeah, we got to have some stuff that's going to help out here. Like, God. Then there was hellfire stew, which was hardtack boiled in water.
I knew it was going to have hardtack in it.
Yeah, yeah, it had to have, right? It had the word hell in it. Like, it's got to have hardtack. Boiled in water and bacon grease. Yeah.
So it was just literally hardtack and bacon grease soup?
Yep.
Honestly, though, with some hot sauce, probably not that bad.
Right, and that's the issue, though. It doesn't say hot sauce. Like, there's no other season. It, like, they didn't say, like, these other ones, it says salt, right? Like, salt and water. So, just hardtack, water, bacon grease, done and done. Like, and then there's lobscouse. Lobscouse was stew of pieces of meat, vegetables, and hardtack.
They're going to the well on the hardtack, and I understand, right. You know, yeah. War effort, you know, low amount of options, but they are really going to the well on the hardtack.
Yeah, yeah. They are using it for anything and everything.
Every recipe you said so far just sounds like some like a divorced dad feeding his kids when they come over on the weekends. Right. You know, like got a couple of crackers and a couple pieces of meat that don't look too bad. They don't smell too funny. So I'm just gonna make soup.
Right. I really didn't expect to have you guys this weekend. So we got some Hellfire stew. It's like, oh no.
Dad, are you okay?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You still have your job, right?
Like, you know, how's your mom and Jeff doing? Are they okay?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't worry about me. How's your mom and her friend? It's like, jeez.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Then there is milk toast. Yeah. This is one I of those that, like, this is a lie. This is what this is.
You're going to say hardtack, aren't you?
You're correct. Hardtack soaked in condensed milk.
Oh.
Yeah. And fun fact, Borden, so the brand Borden, had just started to can. So, yeah. So Borden, Borden condensed milk in a can, poured and soaked with hardtack.
Here's the thing about that strikes me as a possible bad... Beth, other than the hardtack part, that goes without saying.
Right, right.
They had just begun to can. To me, that implies that they probably have not perfected canning.
Right.
This so questionably not... canned right. condensed milk with hardtack.
Right. They haven't quite gotten the like full scope of what they need to do like to make things good yet. They haven't done that research quite yet. It's they're like still they working out the kinks.
Yeah, they told the government, hey, we learned how to can milk. Like, oh my God, you learned how to safely can milk? We didn't say that. We just said we learned how to can it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You said safely. That's
You're filling in a lot of blanks that we didn't say.
Right. Exactly. That is not what the memo said. Yeah. Ugh. And then from mentalfloss.com, you know, going over 8 curious Civil War era recipes we still eat today. This is more of like, this is not during the war effort, right? Like this is, you know, Mr. or Mrs. Smith who are too old, too frail, or maybe too young and too full of life to do anything during that period. If you look at Anne Howe's 1863 classic, The American Kitchen Directory and Housewife, it includes quite a few culinary gems, like plaw, which P-L-A-W, plaw, a Civil War era veal curry. Then there is pressed pig's head, oyster pancakes, and a dish of snow, which is grated coconut with cream. So all of those, very popular, but perhaps the most persistent, so the one we're eating today, is her recipe for chicken pie. Yes, chicken pie.
So chicken pot pie?
That's where it gets murky. It's the historical equivalent of the modern chicken pot pie, but with less vegetables. In fact, none. And more bacon. The only other ingredient. So
better.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so basically it was what, so all I imagine is a chicken pot pie that has that kind of like cream of chicken type filling and then hunks of chicken and bacon. No veggies. None.
I love vegetables and I love a traditional chicken pot pie, but I kind of want to try this.
Right. Yeah. Like what could go wrong with this?
Yeah. I didn't even know anything. Bacon was an option for chicken pot pie. I've never even thought about that.
Right. To me, like, there's a part of me that the second you add bacon, the next question that pops up is, can we add ranch? Like, bacon, chicken, bacon, ranch, pot pie. That,
oh, God.
Yeah.
That sounds like a new dish at Chili's or Applebee's.
Totally. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. Or at Olive Garden, and they're like, we added parsley, so it's Italian.
Yeah. I have thoughts on Olive Garden anyway.
Right. Olive Garden, to me, is a very, I don't want to say divisive, because I think people can agree that it's like, I can eat the stuff there. It's not horrendous. We know it's not authentic.
Right.
But we just have a hard time fully understanding it.
Yeah.
Like, why did you choose this in order to deliver said pasta?
Choices were made.
And right, right.
The amount that they'll give you, too. Like, oh, come into Olive Garden, we'll give you 6 pounds of food.
Right, right.
They know, like, it's not good, but we're going to give you a lot of it.
Right. And they don't have the word buffet anywhere. Right? Yeah. So it's just, when you're here, you're family. And it's like...
And I hate that slogan, too, because when you're here, you're family, that just makes me think they're going to ask to borrow money every time I'm there. That's another reason I don't like to go.
Yeah. They're like, did you enjoy the breadsticks and salad? And you're like, maybe. Why? Do you need something, Derek?
Yeah.
You're here, you're family, you know?
Sir,
like,
yeah.
Come on.
So you need to lower your voice and put your shirt back on. I'm exactly. Family, so...
Yeah.
Okay, this is how I act at my family's house.
Exactly, yeah. Where are my slippers? That's... Yeah. But no, then going on to the Smithsonian Magazine, they are talking about the first breakfast cereal, granola, had to be soaked before being eaten. It was invented by a doctor and health reformer. The brittle cakes were not an instant success. It goes on to say granula, and I'm not saying granola, right? So it's G-R-A-N-U-L-A. So granula wasn't much like the cereal we eat today. It was first manufactured breakfast cereal, and it was developed in 1863 by a doctor and health reformer named James Caleb Jackson. So this was somebody I'm like, I haven't heard this. I've heard the cornflakes thing. I've heard the Wheaties thing. I'm like, what is this guy? So Jackson believed, as many did at the time, that sicknesses were based in the digestive system. And at the health spa he ran in upstate New York, he began experimenting with cold cereal as a cure for illness. He baked graham flour into brittle cakes, which he then crumbled and baked again. It was not an immediate success. In fact, it was edible only when soaked in milk, get this, overnight. So it's like overnight oats, but with this.
Rock-hard cereal.
Rock-hard cereal, yeah. Although Jackson's concoction didn't take off, they write, the idea of cold cereal reached the ears of another pure food advocate, John Harvey Kellogg, who ran his own health spa in the late 1870s or early 1880s. He started making his own granola out of a mixture of wheat flour, oatmeal, and cornmeal. Jackson sued Kellogg, who then renamed his take on breakfast cereal granola. Yeah. Oh,
yeah, and Kellogg, yeah. I mean, that guy had enough sexual hangups that he'd be a great politician today.
Right. You know? Yeah, he definitely would be a senator somewhere that most people just immediately associate with, yeah, that guy. Yeah. But granola had commercial success, unlike granula. Perhaps because it wasn't so closely connected to the recipe for hardtack.
I was going to say the best thing about granola to me is that it didn't include the word hardtack.
Right. And so they go on to talk about like what American breakfast had consisted of. At that time, the standard American breakfast was a cholesterol-laden hot meal of eggs, bacon, sausage, and beef or chicken, plus cooked grains, so hot cereal like oatmeal, biscuits, toast, butter, and jam, she writes. It was part of the British tradition of a lavish breakfast to fortify the gentry for a day of sport. Yeah.
See,
so that sounds way better than a cereal that I've got to soak overnight.
That's got to be a hard sell. Okay, so we know that you're used to bacon, eggs, biscuits, jam, oatmeal, and all that. However, we would like for you to eat hardtack, rock hard cereal, and get shot at.
Have fun. That's what that's good. You know, that's, yeah, it's going to be great.
Man. That, yeah, that is incredible.
Yeah. Granula, whose name is a riff of granules, was a strong departure from this tradition, made of graham flour named for fellow food reformer Sylvester Graham. The cereal was so hard, writes Stephen Mim of Bloomberg Views. Some dubbed it Wheat Rocks. Yeah, that's a great nickname to obtain through.
That's what you want your food name to be known as, right?
Right. Come on, son. We need to eat our Wheat Rocks. It's like, oh. So as for Jackson, although he didn't become a cold cereal magnate, sales of his product and his services at the health spa, then called a sanitarium, ensured that he didn't suffer for lack of money. The Our Home Sanitarium became one of the largest spas in the world. Yeah, Hotchman writes. So that was from Kat Eskner from March of 2017 through Smithsonian Magazine. Talking about granula. Yeah. Yeah. And then another one here, 12tomatoes.com. They go over 6 Civil War era recipes. Once again, for anybody and everybody, you know. And of course, this one is going over the one that I think most people, I don't know if they associate it with the Civil War, so to speak, but they do associate it with America, right? American. Mac and cheese. It has been a hit in the U.S. for centuries, though pasta was a bit of a wild card when Americans first tried it. In any case, the Civil War era recipe for the now classic dish, which was spelled macaroni, so M-A-C-C-A-R-O-N-I, was very simple, as many recipes were back then. It read, boil the macaroni in milk, put in the stew pan butter, cheese, and seasoning. When melted, pour into the macaroni, putting breadcrumbs over, which brown before the fire altogether. We adapted this 1863 recipe for use in a modern kitchen, since most people today find exact measurements pretty helpful. So they made an exact measurement, and it literally looks, it's penne pasta in this bowl, and there's not like a lot of sauce, and then there's like fine breadcrumbs tossed over the top of it. And you can kind of see like a couple little cheese bubbles, but really it just looks like breadcrumbs over penne pasta. Not much sauce.
In my head, though, I just picture some guy just off camera who's like, you know, clutching his hands like Mr. Burns. And he's like, yes, yes, I crushed hardtack on top of it instead of breadcrumbs.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The guy from the hardtack lobby.
Yeah. He's like, you know, it's like, you know, the breadcrumbs are good, but hardtack on top would be nice, too.
Right, exactly.
Big hardtack has to get their hands in it.
I've heard there's a good cheese from Italy called Parmesan. And then he's just like, oh, yes, well, hardtack is exactly like Parmesan.
Yes.
You can just grate this on top of it.
There has to be a guy, Jonathan J. Hardtack, and he's just, you know, he's just behind the scenes of history, just moving everything along. But he's just got to put these little rock cakes in there.
Totally. Yeah, he's that guy. If anything, I bet the last name he has is just Tack, you know? Yeah, they're like, oh, that's old Bob Hard Tack. Yeah, so Bob Tack. He always comes around, and he's always trying to sell his hard tack to everybody. It's like, yep, figures.
Nobody wants your rock crackers, Tack.
Yeah, exactly. Tack, you get out of here. This bar serves mac and cheese and baked beans, and you're in here trying to get your hard tack. Getting it on everybody's plate. Stop it. He's like, okay, fine. I'll leave then. Yeah.
Don't come calling to me whenever you need hard crackers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I heard there's this theme called clam chowder. I'm gonna be making a big hit with it soon. I know. It's like, yeah, sure you are. And then from your neck of the woods, UNC. .edu. So yeah, University of North Carolina. You've got the document from the South, a Confederate receipt book, and it is a compilation of over 100 receipts adapted to the times. And this is the electronic edition. But basically, they've digitized this. And as we talked about before, the word receipt for receipt book or receipts instead of the word recipe, I think it comes from when they were ordering food through your general store. And so you would get the receipt of everything that you bought or that you asked for, and that composed your recipe, right? And so later they started to, like, separate the two words. And that is what I'm going with. Does UNC say that? No. But my little, like, this makes sense meter, this makes sense.
It's off the charts.
It's off the charts. Yeah, just, you know, you call or not call. I keep saying call because that's just what we do nowadays. But back then, you know, you ride your horsey into town and you're like, hey, Bob, don't need any hardtack. But listen, I need, you know, beef, you know, ribs, I need flour, I need salt, da, da, da. You go through the whole list, and then Bob would be like, well, I'm sad to see that there's no hardtack, but it looks like you're making a beef stew. And you're like, maybe, Bob, maybe. And then he would come back and he'd go, well, here is your receipt, once you went and picked up all your goods. And so you were like, aha, I will just follow the receipt and make my meal. Right. And then you'd eat that for like 8 or 9 days because that's all you had. Like, you know,
I love the idea of being coy. There's like, oh, it looks like you're making beef stew. Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe not. I've got this receipt book. It has 100 receipts in it. Yeah, Bob. Huh. Maybe I can make more than one type of meal, Bob.
So here's the thing then. So all those, like, so those family recipes, like, oh, my great 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 grandmother, she came up with this recipe. No, she didn't. She got that from the general store.
Right. Yeah. All of them. And then here it is from the publishers, page 5. You have culinary receipts. And this one says, take 1 quart of flour, 3 teaspoonsful of cream of tartar, mix well through the flour, 2 tablespoonfuls of shortening, 1 teaspoonful of soda, dissolved in warm water, of sufficient quantity to mold the quart of flour. For large families, the amount can be doubled. What do you think that is a receipt for?
I don't know. What is this?
Biscuit.
That's a biscuit.
That is a biscuit. And then there is a receipt for nice buns. Take 3/4 of a pound of sifted flour, 2 large spoonfuls of brown sugar. So this is a sweet roll, that's for sure. 2 spoonfuls of good yeast, not bad yeast. Add a little salt, stir well together, and when risen, work in 2 spoonfuls of butter, make into buns, set it to rise again, and bake on tins. So that is your recipe for nice buns. That is,
see, this is how, yeah, you're more mature than I am, because if I read the recipe for nice buns, I would have had to throw it in there and then do 200 squats.
Right, exactly. And then make sure that you have tight-fitting pants. Like, that is the way to go. And then the next recipe, Indian bread. It is 1 quart of buttermilk, 1 quart of cornmeal, 1 quart of coarse flour, 1 cup of molasses, add a little soda and salt.
Indian that actually bread. Sounds pretty good.
It does. It sounds really good. It sounds like just like a sweet corn bread, like a very sweet corn bread. Especially with the buttermilk, there'd be a tang too.
Yeah. Now, and typically, I don't like a sweet corn bread. There are some. So there are different camps on this, I know, but some people, they like their corn bread on the sweeter side, almost like cake. I like mine more on the savory side. I prefer more of a butter flavor, more of a savoriness. Right. But that actually does sound pretty nice.
It does, yeah. And that's the other thing, too, is I'm sure, just like we do today, I bet back then, you know, whoever was cooking is probably throwing in random things to, like, see if it works, right? So, like, that Indian bread, you throw in some jalapenos.
Now, see, that would be... Yeah, like a nice, a sweet and a spicy kind of compliment.
Right.
That's funny. I never really think about that, but I do wonder, like, just throughout history, I mean, how much were people just, obviously they were experimenting. I mean, that's how we have our culinary world now, is people experimenting, but these things, I wonder, like, to what degree, not even just the creativity, but also just the means. Because, you know, we have a grocery store of items that are two generations back they never heard of.
Right. Yeah. And not only that, but, like, they were doing a lot of the cooking over a flame or an oven-type concept. Like, basically, everything took a little bit of time. So it just goes to wonder, like, did they just think, like, it's already going to take a couple hours. Like, why not just add this in? And,
just to see.
Yeah, just to see. Like, just to go with it. So,
I mean, I can respect that. Because, I mean, my wife and I will joke, if we're going to cook something and we're just kind of gambling, it's like, well, if it sucks, we'll just get pizza. There was no just getting pizza.
Right. Right. It was hardtack.
Yeah. Look, if this is terrible, we either eat it or we eat hardtack.
You're right. Right. We'll have hardtack stew or hardtack hellfire stew. We'll have hardtack with our mac and cheese. Like, it was everything. And then there's a list of puddings here, and there was one pudding that caught my eye. It is called Republican pudding. You take one cup of soft-boiled rice, a pint of milk, a cup of sugar, three eggs, and a piece of butter the size of an egg, and serve, and I quote, with sauce. What is that? What is that? Like, this is just, it is a pudding, and it will have a sauce? Or it is a sauce? Like, what?
This just makes me think of Amelia Bedelia, you know?
Kinda, yeah. Well, and the thing that I got out of that was white. That's what this is. Soft-boiled rice, so white. A pint of milk, white.
White.
A cup of sugar, white. Well, unless it's, like, all natural sugar. It could be kind of brown. But that's, like, brown sugar, too. It has molasses. Anyway, three eggs, a lot of egg whites, and a piece of butter, which white people love butter. So it's just one of those things. Like, this is a white pudding.
it's a Republican pudding, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it perfectly makes sense.
And that is the thing that is its name.
Oh, I know. Yeah. It perfectly fits. It is the glove, right? It fit the hand. Then you've got artificial oysters. You take young.
Oh, this sounds horrible.
Yeah, this is going to be bad. You take young.
I swear to God,
if you say hardtack. From what I can see, no hardtack. But it might become that. You take young green corn. So green corn. We'll see what that is. You grate it in a dish. So you grate it. To one pint of this, add one egg. Well beaten. A small teacup of flour. Two or three tablespoons of butter. Some salt and pepper. And mix them together. Yeah. I don't know how that makes an oyster.
Like
oysters are pretty salty, and so it's like, it just says some salt and pepper. So it's just like,
I love the measurements.
Which,
How much salt and pepper does it call for? Some.
Yeah, some. So like the whole, no. Just like half of it.
just some.
Yeah. And then
how much did you put in there?
Yeah.
A bit. Oh, no. You need to put some in there.
Right. You need to do more than, quite a few. Not more than a some, though. You know? But yeah. Then there is the famous slapjacks, right? So and it does say here, this is where it sounds more like hush puppies, because it says take flour, sugar, and water, mix with or without a little bit of yeast. The latter, better if at hand, mix into a paste. And fry the same as fritters in clean fat. So that makes it sound more like hush puppies than before.
Yeah. So, well, that in the like the fritter, so more of like a hoe cake even.
Right. Yeah. And then there is Indian sagamite. This is three parts of Indian meal. I don't know what that is. And one of brown sugar mixed and browned over the fire. It will make the food known as sagamite. Used in small quantities, it only appeases hunger, but allays thirst and is therefore useful to soldiers on a scout.
Huh.
Yeah. So, great things there. I mean, you know?
I mean,
really great things. Yeah.
This is like, you know, doing what you have to do with what you have.
Totally. Totally. So, and now we go towards past some of the recipes for apple water and cider jelly. and we go even past the soap and candles. They have recipes for soap and candles. Soft soap, honey soap, and then the Confederate candle, which I don't want to know how that's made.
Yeah, fruit of a joke.
Yeah, yeah. But they do have remedies, okay? And I know, as we mentioned before, you had, you know, a little bit of a sniffle, right? So depending on how bad the sniffle is, you can do a gargle for a sore throat, diphtheria, or scarlet fever. I'm sure you were worried about that.
That was actually my next fear was if it's not a cold, it's probably diphtheria.
Right. You mix in a common-sized cup of fresh milk, 2 teaspoonfuls of pulverized charcoal, and 10 drops, so not 9, not 11, 10 drops of spirits of turpentine. Soften the charcoal with a few drops of milk before putting into the cup. Gargle frequently, according to the violence of the symptoms.
That's such a beautiful way to describe gargling turpentine, is there's going to be violence inside of you.
Right, right. You need to gargle this frequently, you know, just according to the violence of your symptoms. Like, what? What now? It's going to be, what?
does it help you feel better? Well, you'll be feeling so terrible from the turpentine in your mouth that you're not even going to be thinking about the sniffles.
Right, right. And then if your sniffles are because of a troublesome cough, they say take of treacle and the best white wine vinegar, 6 tablespoonfuls each. Add 40 drops of laudanum.
Oh, God almighty.
Mix it well and put into a bottle. A teaspoonful to be taken occasionally when the cough is troublesome. The mixture will be found efficacious without the laudanum in many cases.
Yeah, that laudanum, you won't feel bad. You just won't feel.
Right. And then, you know, you get the sniffles, you get a cough. Sometimes, out of nowhere, the tooth starts to ache, right?
As is wont to do.
Right, yeah. You grab powdered alum, will not only relieve the toothache, but prevent the decay of the tooth. Salt may advantageously be mixed with the alum.
They had such an interesting use of the language.
They did. So, also, and the next two here, I'm bringing them up because, you know, for some people it's hard to talk about, but there is a cure for camp itch, okay? You take iodide of potassium, 60 grains, lard, 2 ounces, mix well, and after washing the body well with warm soap suds, rub the ointment over the person 3 times a week. In 7 or 8 days, the acarus or itch insect will be destroyed. In this recipe, the horrible effects of the old sulfur ointment are obviated. Yeah, so camp itch, folks. Get your potassium, your 60 grains, and lard.
I'll be honest, I'm not brave enough to Google camp itch.
I'm not either. And then this one I definitely would need to... this is a cure for a felon. I read that right. Cure for a felon. The Selma Reporter says, a poultice of onions applied morning, noon, and night for 3 or 4 days will cure a felon. No matter how bad the case, splitting the finger will be unnecessary. If this poultice be used, we have seen it tried several times and know that the remedy is a sure, safe, and speedy one. So, I'm guessing a felon is like a splinter.
I'm not sure. As you were reading that, I just started wondering myself, do I have a felon by any chance?
Is
this something I could have?
Yeah, yeah. I hope I'm not being felonious. And then there's miscellaneous receipts. This one is like method of curing bad butter, clarifying molasses. Oh, phone went off. There we go. And then also they've got helpful hints. So to judge the quality of lamb, to test flour, nutmegs, rice glue, how to cement broken china or glass, how to make certain inks, to purify river or muddy water. You can make fireballs for fuel. Then there is, you know, to clean kid gloves, to remove grease from clothing, powder to clean gold lace, how to dry herbs, a cheap taper for a sick room.
And, I know you mean sick room as in a room that, you know, probably needs to be freshened up, but I just imagine a sick room's like, oh, that room's dope.
Right. He's got a car bed. How sweet is that? Like, man. So, that's sick. And then, yeah, it's so sick. And then there is the appendix for recipes for making bread from rice flour. And they talk about journey or Johnny cakes, rice cakes, wafers, rice puffs. And then there's a segment here, hints for ladies. Yep. Some of the more economical readers may be glad to have a little advice as to how to freshen up a dress of which they have got tired or which may be beginning to lose its beauty. Those which are soiled or worn at the bottom may be made up so as to look very well at very small expense and with little trouble. Thus, for a dress of fancy material, a band of alpaca between 5 and 6 inches in width will suffice to renew it. This band should be waved at the top and piped with a thick blue or red piping. The sleeves must have a similar reverse and a little Swiss body. Trimmed also with a piping will complete the costume. For taffetas dresses, the band should be of the same material but black and finished off at the top in the same manner. Or if a more simple arrangement be preferred, it may be headed with 2 or 3 rows of narrow ribbon plaited in the middle. A band might be replaced with 2 flounces or pinked black taffetas. These will have a better effect if placed a little distance from another and with a heading. Did you understand any of that?
I heard the word alpaca. That was about it. Say this: when you said it was something for the ladies, it was better than I expected. I'm thinking 1860s. I'm like, this isn't going to be progressive or good.
Right. Right. I was thinking of, yeah, like, ladies, why are you so bad at cleaning? And you're like, oh no, oh no.
Oh yeah, that's what I was expecting.
Right. And it's just like, ugh, no, no, no. But yeah, they talk about at the very bottom here, it talks about ads or things that were placed in it. And it talks about there were new publications. One was Les Miserables, Now Ready, a novel by Victor Hugo. Yeah.
That doesn't sound like that'll take off.
What a joke.
Yeah. Like, we'll be talking about that in 160 years.
Right. But those, that is our plate in time of 1863. We've got it, man. Just some hardtack, salt meat, get us some, good old cure of camp itch, and, our Indian bread, and of course, the nice buns. You got to have the nice buns.
Yeah. Well, so here's a question. Do you think that they ever tried to cure camp itch with hardtack? I think that was a missed opportunity.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I bet you anything he'd say, just pulverize it into a powder and
boom,
put the powder on. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Bob Tack, get your hardtack. Get it today. It'll cure your camp itch. You can eat it. You can wear it. Doesn't matter.
Hell, I built my last house out of it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing is I know, so like there are like different sheds, you know, things like that were built on farms. They talk about how they would use different crates to build said sheds, but also to insulate them. And so sometimes like in the Midwest or the South, if you go through like
I mean, super old. Like, it's surprising if you find this still. But you would find pieces of wood that had labeling on it, and it was from just a crate that was used for hardtack, for fruit, for whatever, and it had the company name, but obviously it was just like painted over or just stuck in for the insulation. And yeah, pretty interesting stuff to come across a hardtack crate. I mean, man, yeah, the Bob lineage lives.
Yeah. I will say this though. That's one thing that, you know, our ancestors, I think about, I do admire that they, you know, they were more resourceful. They, you know, there was less of this mindset of waste.
Right.
You know, totally. Now everything, it's, what is it, like fast fashion, and it's, you know, single use, quick and easy. This idea that back in the day, they did have to be more resourceful, I mean, in the food that they ate and the materials that they used, that is something I wish we would be more, we'd be better about now.
Right, totally. And like I said, mainly that was in America, right?
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, like, I started thinking about it, and I'm like, well, I'll look around. I know a lot of places are doing traditional things. I didn't want to make it too long, anything like that. But I have a book. It's called Signature Dishes That Matter. It is published by Phaidon, Phaidon. Very good book. Talks about the most influential recipes. Has, like, the Big Mac in it. Like, tells you the recipe of it. It's an interesting book, you know. But it does talk about in the early 1860s. So there's a couple different, you know, pages. It was like 1867, very specific. But this one, in Russia, in the 1860s, Lucine Olivier in The Hermitage came up with Russian salad. So when you hear Russian salad, what do you think?
The first thing I think of is Russian salad dressing, so I'm thinking of a Reuben sandwich.
Right, yeah, yeah. And see, that's the thing. When I thought of Russian salad, like, without the little picture, just reading Russian salad, I immediately know mayonnaise.
Fair. And is there beets in there, too?
Well, this is what it says. What began as a lavish, still-life designed by a French chef to play to the Russian nobility's fondness for French culture, gradually became the most Russian of dishes. What Lucien Olivier first served at the elegant Hermitage restaurant in Moscow was a gathering of the most expensive ingredients. So caviar, grouse, pheasant, lobster, venison, veal tongue, crayfish, and other seasonally changing items, meats and seafood that were only available to the wealthy. In the center of the display were potatoes and hard-boiled eggs. To the chef's horror, the Russian diners mixed everything together on their plates. So rather than object, he reconfigured the dish as a salad, dressing it with a secret Provençal sauce, which he forbade any of his cooks to see him prepare. With the downfall of the aristocracy and the arrival of communism, such a salad would seem to be distinctly anti-state. So in 1930, Olivier's former apprentice, Comrade Ivanov, updated it at the Moskva Hotel, exchanging grouse for the more proletariat-friendly chicken and carrots for the crayfish, with canned peas and potatoes, lowering it further to meet the masses. The industrialized production of mayonnaise made it widely available, a cheap source of calories and protein for the people. And so it became the binding element of many of the dishes, especially this salad, which over time became an endlessly mutable amalgam containing diced chicken, potatoes, eggs, pickles, and canned peas, drenched in sweet vegetable oil-based Provençal mayo. As white Russian émigré came with it, it became known around the world simply as Russian salad. Today, it is centuries and worlds away from the French chef's original creation, a ghost of the Gilded Age. Yeah.
I'm looking at pictures of it right now, and this looks like a very, this looks like a Russian dish.
Totally. Totally.
Not like, fancy.
It fits the bill in the name again, like a glove. Like, it is just, like, perfectly put on there. By far, I've read the whole book. This was one of the more interesting recipes that were in there. Just because, you know, like they said at the start of it, this was fancy. Fancy-pantsy. Yeah.
This is where I love the idea that food, I mean, it gets freestyled so much. I mean, I look at this, and it's easy to poke fun at, but I would try this.
Totally.
Yeah. I don't know how good it would be, but I would definitely try this.
Well, and it just makes me think that, like, somebody ate this and immediately thought, oh, this is like potato salad.
Yeah.
And so they just made potato salad, and then they're like, oh, well, it's made of potatoes. Why don't we just put pasta in it? And then it was macaroni salad. Like it was the start of the salads, the mayonnaise-based salads.
I do love the idea of a salad that doesn't involve anything green. It's just mayonnaise-based.
Right.
But just Googling Russian salad right now, it has the list of questions on the side or different things that people ask about it. And one of them is Russian salad good for health? And you click on it. There's not even like a long explanation. It's just clear, no, this is not healthy.
No, this is not healthy.
It's a very Russian response. No, no, it's not healthy. Yeah, it's not healthy.
No, it's not healthy. No.
It's good, da. Is healthy? No.
No, no. It'll make you feel like a snishka, you know? I know that means like sunshine, like my little sunshine or something in Russian. I do know that. Solnishka. But that is our full plate in time, including the American side, but at least throughout the world, Russian salad, early 1860s, created by Lucien Olivier at the Hermitage in Moscow, Russia. Yeah. So,
my next step is I need to go get some hardtack.
Right. Yeah, I need to get hardtack. Need to make sure that somehow I can blend it with mayonnaise. That way I can make a Russian salad with some side fake meat, so rice and molasses.
Yeah. Fake oysters. Yeah.
Fake oysters, right. But also, you know, I'll let my wife read the hint for the ladies, you know. So, I mean, great all around 1863. Thank God I didn't live in that time. It was not great.
Yeah, I will say one thing. I feel like if I lived in that time, I would not have a weight problem. I would be skinnier, so there is that.
Totally. Yeah. Wouldn't have to worry about the calorie intake, I've got a feeling. Yeah. But no, 1863, wow, what a wonderful year. Going to the random year generator now, where do you think we're headed next? It is from 1800 to 2019. So any year between that.
My hope would be the 1950s because I want you to have to talk about items that are just encased in Jell-O.
Aspic, yeah. Aspic, Jell-O, yeah. See, that's the thing. I almost want something in, like, the 1920s that should have been, like, for the rich. Like, obnoxiously rich. But, now it's, like, something that we serve in a drive-through, like that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Well, so you know, it's funny. When you look back on time like that, so back in the day, like the rich people ate, you know, all this meat, and I'm like, I can go to Arby's and get a sandwich. It's like a half a pound of meat. It's like listening to old hip hop now, or you know,
right?
Notorious B.I.G.'s. You know, he's rapping about having an N64 and a 40-inch TV. It's like I got a 43-inch TV in the living room and a PS4. I mean,
right? Yeah. I mean, it's just one of those things. Over time, I mean, we just grab those things that we think are fancy. We give it to the masses, and then they try to come up with something fancier, you know?
Exactly.
Something higher up the totem pole, you know? But yeah, so I'm hoping it's around then. I will hit the generator now. Oh, 1819.
Ooh.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
That would be interesting.
Lisa will be no hardtack. That's what I'm guessing.
That's
hoping.
The one constant that was hardtack.
Right. I've got a feeling 18, 19, there's going to be a lot of game meat. Pheasant, deer, elk.
Maybe even tree bark. I could see some tree bark.
Totally. Yeah, spruce trees or something.
Rock soup.
Yeah, rock soup. Definitely. Yeah, the wheat. Maybe before then, Mr. Kellogg or Jackson, or they had a predecessor in 1819 that was like, I'm going to make oat rocks. roll it in a ball down this hill, and it goes into a barrel, and that's how we got our oat rocks.
just like Mama made.
Yep, just like how Mama used to make them. You roll the oat down the hill, and then it goes into the barrel, and you take the barrel home with your horsey, and it everything fine. It's like, yeah. Oh, wonderful.
Doesn't get better than this.
Yep. The wonderful times of 1819. Because, nothing bad was going on then.
I'm sure
of it. Oh, no. Anyway. But, Andrew, I appreciate you coming on. And our last meal, definitely everybody check it out. Listen to it like crazy. It's really, really good. I was a guest on there, going over, talking about, just folks that maybe have, gone away with time or have passed. And your last meal with them, it's wonderful. It's great. Go ahead and talk about it for a little bit here. The main thing with the idea of going about and doing our last meal, I wish I had come up with it sooner. I really did. but no, you're perfect for it. How is that going?
Oh man, it's going really well. It's an interesting concept to me because I and you and I have talked about this. I think there's this connection that we have with people through food. There are certain dishes and just certain foods. I can take a bite of something right now and immediately think about my grandmother. Or think about my mom. If I eat a bowl of chicken and dumplings, that's a comfort food that I grew up with, and it makes me think about my mom.
Totally.
But people have this connection to loved ones through food. And I know that we lose people throughout our life, be it through death, through growing apart, through breaking up. And I just want to give this, use this podcast as a chance to give people space to honor people that they've lost, or even just, talk about a relationship that they've lost and just how that connected, to food, and just, let them kind of relive that. And, I think one of the things I'm learning as I talk to more people is that, it is a chance for people to kind of grieve something openly that they haven't been able to do before. And that's something I want to try to provide people. So totally. If you're interested, Our Last Meal is on all the major platforms. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Our Last Meal Pod, or ourlastmeal.com. And if anyone's ever interested in being a guest, there's a space there that you can go to share your story and come on the podcast and talk.
Absolutely. And I advise it. Like you were saying, it is a good space to kind of just talk about those things that kind of connect us with others. Like you were saying, whether they've passed or you've just lost, connection with them or lost touch with them. It's one of those emotions that, like you were saying, everybody has watched the movie Ratatouille, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And the critic, he bites into the Ratatouille. I'm not spoiling anything. It's one of those things where everybody has those moments, but it's not just one dish, right? There's so many foods that, you try it, you eat it, and it takes you back to a certain time, a certain place, certain family members, friends, things over time. And it's just one of those things that, like I said, I love it because, like I said, there's so many things that I connect through food. And I know that's not, everybody's way of connecting things, right, through the past. But I feel like it is a great way of remembering it. It's a good marker, I was thinking about it after, I was on the episode with you. And I started thinking about just like a place and time, And I was thinking about Frito pie. Frito pie, man. I used to eat. It was always in the cold of winter. And I say winter, it was like fall. So like October, November, like that kind of, and it was always chilly, crisp air, whatever. And me and my brother both, we played baseball, and we would go to this place. It was a Fordland complex, and it had all these baseball fields, but we would play baseball. That was like late into the season, and you'd play baseball tournaments, you know, what have you. There was nothing better than like my little tiny gloved hands wrapped around a little tiny bag of Fritos with chili poured over the top and little onions and a little bit more cheese, like, put on top of that. And then, like, you could get sour cream. You could. I was a kid. I didn't like any of the other good stuff. But basically, that would all be in this little bag. And that bag, as you're eating it, it's, like, warming your hands up. And you're just eating out of a Fritos bag, this Frito pie. And anytime I eat Frito pie, whether it's out of a bag or it's in a bowl, I go back to that of like little, you know, Devin between the ages of like 8 and 12, where I'd be watching my brother playing baseball, and I would go to the, you know, little concession stand, and I think it was like $1.50 for Frito pie. And then I would ask my mom for $2, because that extra 50 cents got me gummy worms.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. So Frito pie and gummy worms. And I'd sit in my little, you know, it was like not a lawn chair, but like a, what do they call that? Oh, man. Is it like a lawn chair? Well, it's like a, it's one of those chairs that, you know, it's a foldable chair. Man, is it just a lawn chair? I think that's so. Just what people call it. Yeah, it's a lawn chair. Anyway, I'd, you know, carry my chair in, I'd sit down, and it was always like around the third or fourth inning, I would start looking at my mom, and I'm like, hey, you know what we're going to have for dinner? Like at all? You know? And she'd be like, I don't know, Devin. We'll have to wait and see once we get home. I'm like, oh, so we're not going to like stop at Hardee's or like McDonald's, pizza, maybe, you know, order pizza or anything. Devin, I don't know. We'll see whenever we get home. I'm like, well, you know, my mom's like, here's $2. I'm like, okay, thank God. Like, you know, and I'd run to that concession stand, and I'm like, first, I need my gummy worms, and please, sir, Frito pie, please. No sour cream, no green onion, thank you.
Let me ask you, when was the last time you had a Frito pie and gummy worms?
Oh, man. So gummy worms, I am a gummy fiend. So the best movie candy is gummy anything. Gummy bears, gummy worms, peach rings, Sour Patch Kids. That's another one. Because you can chew on it and it doesn't make any noise. So you That's can fair. Still hear the movie. And none of that will, like, it can get stuck in your teeth, but it's easily removable. Popcorn, you get it stuck in your teeth, makes crunching sound, you can't hear stuff sometimes. You have to pop it in a microwave or on the stove or something, you can get burned kernels or whatever. No, you can just gummy it. Get gummies. They are way better. And so I eat those as often as I can, whether it's in worm form, bears, twin snakes, which is like a huge favorite of mine. Haribo twin snakes. One is sour, one is sweet. They're amazing. And then Frito pie, I would say that me and my wife, we will have Frito pie probably once every like year and a half or so. We'll buy a bag of Fritos, and then just immediately it's like, oh, do we have chili? And then we just mix it together and eat it in a bowl or what have you. But Frito pie, right now, very rare to have Frito pie, you know.
Well, I was going to say, it's one of the, I would encourage people, I mean, that those foods that you have a connection with, you know, maybe it's not something you should, you know, maybe Frito pie is not something you should eat all the time. You know, for me, it's right. I think about the Little Debbie donut sticks that my grandmother used to give me.
Oh, man.
But, yeah. I mean... Yeah. But just, it is something I think is important to take you back and just to have that connection. Just to, sometimes you just have to treat yourself and just,
yeah.
Go in on it a little bit.
Totally. I cannot agree more. It's something that it's like some people, I think it's, let me put it this way. It is the safest form of nostalgia that you can have.
I'd agree with that. I would agree with that.
There are some pretty toxic forms of, like, nostalgia, but I think with food, it's the safest form of nostalgia. You know, you just, you sit back and you eat those things, and like you were saying, it just connects you to that person, that time, you know, and it goes throughout, and it just kind of encapsulates everything, right?
Well, and it's one of those things you can share, too. I've got a five-year-old,
Yeah.
You know, I think about like things that I grew up loving that I can share with her now, and it tastes pretty much the same. So it's something, it can connect from generation to generation.
Yeah.
You know, whether you know it or think about it or not, it's food. And this is what I love about food, is that food is this great, it's a great equalizer in that everybody has to eat.
Yep.
Everybody's got a favorite dish. There are some weird people who just view food as fuel. Personally, I cannot. I just can't think about it that way.
Yeah.
But it,
I have a
really
tongue.
Yeah. I've got a tongue. It works. I want to get my use out of it.
Right. Yeah.
But it's a great way to it's a great way to learn about other cultures, and you know, to get to know other people. You know, I think if you ever meet a new person and you wanna break the ice, you know, and in a way that's not typical, ask them, what's your favorite food?
Right. You know.
Because it's a deeply personal thing, but at the same time, it's not a thing that's too personal to ask, you know?
Totally, yeah.
If somebody asked me, like, if somebody met me on the street and said, what's your favorite food? I would have to I would have to stop and think to give them a thoughtful answer, but it wouldn't be like, you know, what color underwear are you wearing today? It wouldn't be too personal or to be weird, but
totally.
It's a great way, I think, to get to know somebody.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite questions to ask is, especially if it's within like your vision line or you can smell it or something, is asking somebody what they would order at XYZ fast food place, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's always, I find like you can really know a lot about a person by like their McDonald's or Taco Bell order. Like you can very easily, like, you know, just kind of be like, oh, okay. Like, sure. Like, if somebody says that at Taco Bell, they always get the Fiesta potatoes, immediately, in my mind, they're, like, whatever classification you put on people, they've hit gold star status, like, immediately. I'm like, dude, yes. Like, Fiesta potatoes. Those were the jam.
Well, for me, I know that person likes to party. I mean, they're
right.
Fiesta potatoes.
They're Fiesta potatoes. They ain't, you know, couch potatoes. No.
These ain't your grandma's potatoes. These are Fiesta potatoes.
Yeah. These are south of the border. Ay, 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 potatoes, okay?
Yeah.
That's what this is. Yeah. And then it's one of those things, like McDonald's. If I hear somebody say, like, you know, oh, I always get the, you know, chicken nuggets, you're kind of like, what sauce?
Hot mustard.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I'm a honey mustard, ranch, or the sweet and sour. Love me some of the sweet and sour. Because it's not sweet or sour. It's just a weird thing at McDonald's.
Yeah. Well, see, I love their buffalo sauce, but my wife got me turned on to the hot mustard, and that was a game changer for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got that zip. You know what I mean? Like, it's just...
That is exactly like, how to describe it. It's got a little bit of zip on it.
Yeah. Ugh. It's wonderful. But see, that's what we're talking about, folks, is talk to people, eat the food, please don't buy Bob Tack's hardtack, and we will see everybody next time on A Plate in Time in 1819. Andrew, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will see everybody next time. Goodbye.
This episode of Culinary Convo was written, produced, edited, and created by yours truly, Devin Ream, and is a part of Mouthful Productions. Please check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Culinary Convo, and our website, culinaryconvo.com, for recipes, episodes, resources, and send an email to culinaryconvopod@gmail.com with your fan suggestions or recipe submissions. You can also support the podcast by going to anchor.fm/culinaryconvo1/support so we can purchase cooking, or audio equipment to help create a better podcast, or by using the funds to help further the exploration of Culinary Convo by ordering subscription boxes, food kits, or ordering food products to review. So shout out to our first supporter, Convonaut Dylan. Thank you. I also want to give audio credit to Soundtrap for our intro, transitions, and outro music. Thank you.